Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem celebrates Mass in London's Westminster Cathedral to raise awareness about the plight of the Holy Land's dwindling Christian community. They call themselves the Lord's Resistance Army, but have little to do with the God most of us know. We talk to one Sudanese bishop about how the vicious militant group's actions are affecting the local population in the south. And a giant soul for a little lady. We find out why Australians want this young woman made a saint. He's come from the heart of the Church in the Holy Land to preach in the heart of the Catholic Church in England, London's Westminster Cathedral. Archbishop Fuad Twal, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, is in the British capital to celebrate Mass at the cathedral and bring more attention to the economic and demographic woes which the Holy Land's Christians have been facing for decades. At a talk following Tuesday's liturgy, Patriarch Twal was due to outline the challenges facing Christians and the impact of Pope Benedict XVI's visit to the region last May.
This is the first chance, really, that we can really have to assess the impact of that visit and to draw out from it the particular concerns, especially facing the Christian community.
John Pontifex is the press officer for the London-based Aid to the Church in Need, which helped organize the Patriarch's London visit. He spoke to Irene Lagan ahead of Tuesday's liturgy.
We know that the future of Christianity in the Middle East, in large part, hangs in the balance because of widespread immigration. And the difficulty there is that Christians feel under pressure from a number of factors. Poverty is one, oppression is another, and a gradual feeling of the decline of the influence of Christianity on the ground in society, which is making them feel that they should follow those many others among their community and go abroad, seek sanctuary, to seek a new life in another country. And this is raising big, big questions for the long-term future of the church there. You know, the Pope was very, very clear in saying to the people of the Holy Land, repeatedly he urged them to feel that the Holy Land is the place not only of their past, but of their future as well. And in various leaflets and other information at Aid to the Church in Need, what we've done is to focus on the centre points, the key note speeches that the Pope made, in which he singled out the need for the Christian community to feel that they belong to the land, to the Holy Land. And if I may, I just quote a little bit from what the Pope had to say at one of his speeches, this one in Amman in Jordan. He said, "Fidelity," speaking to the people of the Holy Land, he says, "Fidelity to your Christian roots, to the Church's mission in the Holy Land, demands from you a particular kind of courage, the courage of conviction, the courage to work with other Christians in the service of the gospel, and the courage to build new bridges with people of different religions and cultures." So the Pope was really saying to them, to look, please, don't give up. And we want to echo that call on his behalf and enable Patriarch Twal to have the space to say that to us here in the West, in London.
Is this the first time that Fuad Twal will be visiting London?
It's the first official visit of its kind to London since he was made Patriarch in the summer of last year. So from that point of view, it has huge significance. Of course, he's been a coadjutor there for some years in Jerusalem, but this follows on directly from his being made the Patriarch.
Catholics or Christians in London or in England aware of the situation of Christians in the Holy Land? And do you expect that this then will raise a lot of consciousness about their plight?
We are very lucky at Aid to the Church in Need in that we have a very generous support base, not only in terms of their willingness to be supportive of the projects that Aid to the Church in Need is developing under the aegis of the Patriarch, but generous in terms of their solidarity. And it's with that in mind that we had the confidence to go ahead and mount this fairly major program for him. And we expect a good turnout at Westminster Cathedral on Tuesday, the 8th of September at 5:30 for the Mass that the Patriarch will celebrate and for the talk that will take place in the hall directly afterwards. So we're confident that will be well received by people, and we hope that that will provide a springboard not only for greater awareness, but also for people feeling that they themselves can actually do something to help, particularly by supporting some of the projects that Aid to the Church Need has in mind, but also through the very powerful effect of prayer. This is a time for, in a way, for people to feel that they can join hands across continents and work in solidarity with those Christians less fortunate themselves and who are feeling increasingly isolated in their own country. It would be a tragic situation if in our lifetime we were to see the gradual decline of Christianity in the birthplace of Christ.
John Pontifex is the head press officer for the London-based Aid to the Church in Need. They are some of the most vicious and heartless militants in the world, who have no qualms about massacring thousands of innocents. They are the footmen of Joseph Kony's guerrilla group, the Lord's Resistance Army, which, since 1987, has been waging a campaign to overthrow Uganda's government and establish a theocratic state based on the Ten Commandments and local Akoli tradition. But far from the God-given rules of the Ten Commandments most of us would know, Kony's foot soldiers have followed what seem to be rules of their own diabolical making. The LRA is responsible for tens of thousands of abductions of children and women forced into becoming soldiers themselves and sex slaves. Many are severely beaten, tortured, and disfigured. Many are forced to kill family members or friends. Nearly 2 million civilians have been forced to flee their homes, living in internally displaced person camps and on the streets.
There is a huge number of internally displaced people who have moved from those places. And then secondly, they have moved into the homes of the host community. Host families, they don't want to create camps for themselves. They come and enter into homes, and you find one household has a huge, huge number of people.
Bishop Edward Kusala of Tombura Yambio in southern Sudan says the LRA are now operating out of Sudan and nearby Democratic Republic of Congo, forcing hundreds out of their homes and villages. People in his own diocese are afraid.
Their presence in the towns, in fact, has caused big alarm. Concentration on the little resources we have, like schools, hospitals, water points. And on the basis of this, we have been making a lot of appeal on the side of the church to for the people to collaborate, to work together. And not too much has been realized. Anyway, from the side of the people, at least collaborations are there.
Bishop Kusala told Lydia O'Kane about the recent troubles that his diocese has been facing. Southern Sudan had enjoyed a fragile peace with the Khartoum government, he acknowledges, but now the LRA has turned any hopes for peace upside down.
When they come to areas, the way they behave is terrible. They abduct the young people, they kill those who are resistant or the old elder people, and they kidnap with them so many, and you never see them again. And when even they kill, it's not a proper killing. It's inhuman. They cut people into pieces. They do all kinds of evil on the bodies of people they kill. With this, it has continued all over the area. And now even because the whole movement of the LRA is at the border between Congo and Sudan, the people in Congo have run over to Sudan. We have over 25,000 refugees from Congo in a place, in one of my parishes called Izo, and then we have another one in Yambio, which is Mopondo, which has 17,000 people. And there are many others that who are not in the camps that live within the villages and the towns in the area in the Sudan. What are the responses? We make advocacy on behalf of this, and many church organizations have tried to pay attention to us, and they still try to assess, you know, the bureaucracy within the international NGOs. But I'm very thankful to CAFOD and Caritas Germany, Caritas Internationalis, Aid to the Church in Need, and the CRS. This group have been able to come to our aid, but we are still working on the modality because the number of people is so huge, to see how best we can be able to support them. So the resources we have is very meager. Right now for schools, the children have to stay under the trees in order to learn. And when the rain comes, you know our area is a rainy season, all is bad. Another major problem, fear I have, is there is going to be famine in the whole state next year or soon this year. Because the area is agricultural, people in that area live by growing their own food stuff. But now with the conflict, nobody's able to go to the forest, to the fields to cultivate. So they all keep themselves within the towns. So you can imagine that there's going to be a huge number of people looking for food aid. And we don't have yet the possibility to have this food available for the people. The second worrying factor is with the presence of the LRA in the area, there is not any single visible sign or program or plan to get rid of coney from that forest. Right from my government of the National Unity, government of Southern Sudan, and the international community, there is no sign, no program. Yes, you see soldiers moving around, but you just wonder, a handful of men in the forest can defeat the whole Sudanese army, can defeat the whole, now we have the Ugandan army that have come in, can defeat these people, and they can defeat the international community. And they're telling me that, no, this man is a rebel, is a guerrilla. Guerrillas can be arrested. If there's a goodwill, there's a really interest, I'm sure Kony can be stopped and from doing what he's doing. This is the second. The third worrying point is, as this problem continues to grow, there are a lot of dissatisfaction among the people of the area. People are very sad. People are frustrated. They live in fear. And they ask many answerable questions, which they don't find answers to them. And to me, as I read it between the lines, It's a boiling point within the hearts of the people. It can explode into something very bad. It's going to cause tribal conflict. It's going to cause a genocide. It's going to cause any kind of unrest in the area. So I have this as a worrying point, and we have so much important programs to come in the future. To me, it's deplorable. It's terrible, and it needs an attention. So here I also remain in a dilemma when I have to think of the international community. I know that, of course, what always happens is international community come in when people have already died and there's already life lost, and then people come in and ask questions. Maybe that's what they're waiting for in Equatoria. So this is the situation we go through at this moment.
The international community has come so far, but they don't seem to have gone far enough on this issue. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And actually, this is the nightmare for most of us in Sudan. We know that the international community worked very hard to get the peace that we have now. They spend a lot of resources, human and material and financial resources, in order to get this peace signed. With the signing of the peace agreement, we have a feeling that they have just given up and have left the situation as it is. But there's not yet peace. And I believe the whole of South Sudan, all the states in South Sudan, are unstable. They are not in peaceful situation. It's not only the situation in Western Equatoria. Ours is the presence of the Ugandan rebels in the area. But in the neighboring states have tribal conflicts. They have militias. They have certain banditry group. So these are indications that might have been some working groups behind these things, behind the scene. We are wondering, because you sometimes get this, some ethnic groups, some militias with a lot of weapons, a lot of ammunition. Where do they get these things from? And as it goes on with all these confusions, we don't see any clear stand in a way like putting our government on the ground and say, look what's going on. And both the government and the North, you never hear any comment about this. It's not that the affair for South Sudan. But we are also, in a way, working towards maybe the United Sudan. How do we live? If they talk making peace, unity, and attractive, it means every Sudanese is supposed to pay attention to the welfare of everybody so that we feel as a people of one nation. This, again, to me, I feel that there's not much being done from the side of the international community. Here we have many major European countries that were involved in the signing of the agreement. The European Union, the American government, the IGAD, all these people, you seem to see a lot of bureaucrats, a lot of offices, a lot of structures have been created. And what I'm talking about, if you look at the structure in Sudan, you will find a lot of commissions, committees set up for monitoring the peace implementation. But what's happening? We don't hear any condemnation of these things and no serious engagement of the people in charge. So people let things go as they are. Of course, as believers, we keep on hoping and we hope things will change, but we need to see it concretely being realized that people follow up the peace implementation, and also knowing the consequences of the 2012 referendum which is going to take place in Sudan. The end could be terrible. So people need to be prepared, and this is the humble time that both the American government, the European Union, need again to revise their collaborative effort to see that peace is built in Sudan. So we are on the hope, and we keep on talking about this and calling on these recognized bodies to see that the conflict in the country be stopped forever.
And a warm thanks there to Bishop Edward Kusala of the Southern Sudanese Diocese of Tombura, Yambio. She was a lady who wouldn't take no for an answer, not when illness and fate partially crippled her as a child, nor when people told her she was attempting the impossible by ministering to the poor in a Sydney suburb. Eileen O'Connor never outgrew the size of a child, but her work with the poor and needy in the seaside neighborhood of Coogee gave her a giant-sized reputation for kindness and determination. By the time she died at just 28, Eileen had established Our Lady's Nurses for the Poor, a small group of dedicated nurses who cared for the sick. Almost a century later, Eileen's nurses have become a congregational order of sisters called Our Lady's Nurses.
She was quite determined, and she just kept battling away, and she did so in ways that you just have to admire her.
John Hosey tells her story in his biography, Eileen, The Life of Eileen O'Connor.
If we're to become holy, we need to do so in a context, the context of our lives. And Eileen's life was lived in extraordinary pain, far beyond anything that most of us experience. She was confined to a bed for long periods, and yet she achieved a great closeness to God and to His Blessed Mother. She reached out with great compassion, and that was far more difficult for her than for most people, because she was confined to a bed for such long periods. And yet she understood their need and worked out a system of helping them, which was very effective and continues to the present day. She also had a great effect on other people. They came to see her and to listen to her. They asked her about their problems. They asked her for prayers to help them or to help members of their family. And yet when they did so, she often said to them, "Would you pray for me?" And literally got them to do so right there in her room, which surprised them, but it showed an understanding of how she saw the value of other people's prayers. I think these are some of the things that I found about Eileen that make me convinced that she's a very special person.
Our Lady's Nurses have put forward an application to make Eileen O'Connor a saint. Do you think she'll make it?
It's difficult to say that, but as a church historian, I can think of a great many who we call saints who wouldn't match up to Eileen's level of personal holiness and to the simple goodness which she achieved in her life. She's also a lay person. I think we have often overlooked the way in which lay people lived and so forth. The church hasn't recognized people like Eileen often enough. And it's very important then because of that side of her and her deep spirituality.
Besides these very important qualities, let's say, her body is reported to have remained incorrupt. Also, she reportedly had visions of the Virgin Mary, and some people have even said that they've been healed of their illnesses in her presence. How much truth is there in these stories?
There's a lot of validity in that these things were recorded and reported at the time. For instance, that one of the nurses wrote to her mother within 3 days, describing with an extraordinary excitement almost of what she saw, and described it in detail, which I've quoted in the book, which tell of just how much that meant to her. But at the same time, it's something that I saw when I was going into the convent at Nevers, where the incorrupt body of Saint Bernadette is preserved. There's a sign in French that says, "Bernadette is not a saint because she saw Our Lady, but because of the kind of life she led afterwards."
Very thought-provoking words there, of course. Let's go back another moment. Eileen never saw her application accepted for Vatican recognition of her small congregational order. That wasn't to come until 1953, which was 33 years after her death. Why did it take so long?
There were a number of reasons, but among them were the facts that she had been through a great many difficulties at the time of her life. She had been struggling to see the nurses and their work recognized. There was a priest, Father Ted McGrath, a Sacred Heart father, who worked with her and helped her a great deal, making up for her lack of physical mobility and so forth by being prepared to go out and do things and meet people. And he became the target of a priest who was sent out to look at difficulties in his order in Australia at the time. this priest decided to make examples of Father McGrath and another priest, even though theirs were not the issues on which he'd been sent to Australia. And he expelled Father McGrath from the Sacred Heart Order and also from the priesthood. Afterwards, Eileen said to Father McGrath, "You're not going to receive justice in Australia. If you want justice, you'll have to go to Rome." And so, despite all her own physical disabilities, she encouraged him to go to Rome, and she herself travelled with a nurse companion and chaperone. They got to Rome and they fought out the cases. Father McGrath was reinstated in his order. Eileen's case did not have success in that application, and for those reasons, and also because the Archbishop of Sydney was not supporting her at that time, he did so after her death, there was no question of the possibility in her short life of progressing the order towards establishment. That was undertaken by Cardinal Norman Gilroy in the early 1950s, as you said.
What would you say Eileen's legacy is today?
Her legacy is a person who was crippled by an accident when she was a child and never was more than 115 centimetres, that's about 3 foot 10 inches in height. For that reason, disregarded by a lot of people as trivial and unimportant. Today, I think a lot more attention is paid to people who are disabled in some kind of way. She's an example for them. She's an example for all of us who face pain, and often people facing that have very little to cling on to. She wasn't living in an age when the medicines that are today used to counteract pain were used, even though they were available, for anyone with an ongoing pain. And so the pain she faced was extraordinary. She's also a very bright and cheerful kind of a person. She loved children and she spent time with them. So that in all of those ways, she stands to us as somebody we can look up to. She can be a person for Australia, as somebody very special, and we don't have enough who are giving examples like that. We have Mary MacKillop. We have another who founded a religious order, is now Blessed Mary MacKillop. We have Caroline Chisholm, who did extraordinary work helping migrant girls travelling to Australia and looking after them when they arrived. And here's Eileen at the beginning of the 1900s doing work among poor people when a government did nothing to help them in any kind of way that enabled them to even see a doctor, let alone go into hospital if they were ill.
John Hosey, church historian and author of the book Eileen, The Life of Eileen O'Connor. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tracy McClure.
Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.